Louis de Rolle thought he was a botanist. Then he discovered kelp was not a plant. Today he is considered the kelp farming grandfather or kelp guru, and the potential uses are endless. Funny how life is like that, right? I'm Robin. Thanks for joining me for Tributaries. Louis, have you heard the world is discovering seaweed and kelp, and they say it has many uses?
Yes, I happen to have heard this, and it's a delightful surprise.
Yes.
Had quite a long period of drought, of people realizing the potential of kelp. There's been little flare-ups now and then, like during the OPEC crisis, when oil prices went sky high. The U.S. explored kelp as a possible biogas or gasoline substitute, but then that OPEC crisis went away, as did the kelp interest. So, yes, it's nice to hear it coming up again, and maybe it'll sustain.
Yes, hopefully, because I guess right now, perhaps, it's more in its potential stage.
Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. I'm most familiar with what's happening here in British Columbia, Canada, and right now I'm looking at four companies that are very seriously exploring going into the kelp cultivation business in a large way, and they have focuses such as one is going into horticultural products. Another one is going into pharmaceutical products. And then one that I work with personally and I'm aware of is Cascadia Seaweeds, which is going into the production of farmed kelp for human protein. And in a very big way, they're shooting to be the largest kelp cultivation outfit in North America by the year 2023. So they're all going at it from different angles. And then, of course, on top of all that, people that are interested in environmental remediation.
Yes.
Now, this is outside of British Columbia, but it's say the sea. We share the city with Washington State. And there we have the Puget Sound Restoration Fund that's looking at carbon sequestration by kelp in a very big way. This is a very important aspect right now of the carbon balance and downloading the high carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yes. Now, I would like to speak a little more fully on some of those topics, but my gosh, since the early 70s, as a marine biology professor, you were researching kelp. So you've definitely watched seaweed's use go in and out of vogue for quite some time now. And as you were starting this research, were you aware, or did you think it had so many potential uses, and what got you so interested in it initially?
Well, I'm a botanist at heart, and it was a love situation. It wasn't driven by any rational vision of the future. I wanted to understand this group of plants better. There's a bit of a joke here. I was trained as a botanist.
Right.
I worked on kelp as my main topic. And then one of my students discovered that kelp was not a plant. It's a protist. So all of a sudden, I can't really call myself a botanist anymore. This is quite an ego blow.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, anyway, it started off without any great vision of the future. Just trying to understand a problem at hand.
Yes. Now, what did you call it? You said it wasn't a plant. It was a...
protist.
Okay.
So this is things like amoeba, a lot of the phytoplankton, the little swimming things in the fresh water and seas.
Yes, yes.
Things like some of the molds that we would otherwise call fungi are protist.
Amazing, amazing.
So they're real insignificant, but important things, a lot of diseases and such. But they're not apparent. But amongst the group is this big elephant in the room called kelp.
Yes.
It's a very large plant. It's very conspicuous. See, I can't not say plant. I mean, it has all these attributes of a plant, except at the molecular level, at the DNA level, it's definitely not a plant. And also its sexual reproduction is very unique and very protease-like and not plant-like, but more animal-like.
Amazing.
So for this reason, I sometimes refer to them as plantimals.
That's my kind of science. Now, excuse me if this is a silly question. Should we further delineate then between algae and seaweed and or kelp and seaweed?
Well, kelp is a seaweed.
Yes, okay.
And so is nori. So nori, a red alga, is a plant. But the brown algae, well, which kelp is one, are protees.
Okay.
So the word algae is a big group. It goes from everything from bacteria-like things, photosynthetic bacteria, these blue-green algae that contaminate swimming holes and such, up to kelp and then things like sea lettuces. So it's a very heterogeneous group. I think the only thing they all have look a little bit like plants or a lot like plants, and they live in the sea.
You are in British Columbia. What is it about that area that makes it such a great hotbed for that?
Almost everything that we have here we share with southern Alaska and Washington State and a bit of Oregon, in that we have an extremely rich flora. We have over 20 species of kelp. I live in Banfield, and within a mile of where I am right now, I can find easily 10 species, and if I worked hard, up to 20. So this gives us a kind of a palette to work from when we're thinking about rearing a plant for a man's use. Whereas in the Atlantic, they have maybe 4 species, of which 2 are commonly cultivated. But we can cultivate all types of plants here and come up with an interesting array of raw material that people that are interested in plastics or horticultural products and such can choose from.
Now, having the first kelp farm outside of Asia, did you go to Asia? And what did you learn about the farming? And is there a key point that you came away with from this ancient culture?
Yeah, so this is the early 80s. My provincial government, bless their heart, in a proactive sense, retained me and a group of other researchers to come up with a farming strategy for British Columbia for kelp. I headed this up, and the first thing I did was I went to Japan. I spent a year there, a very delightful year in Hokkaido, where I learned a great deal about what they're doing. And my chief technician went to Germany and worked with a man by the name of Klaus Lunin, who knows all about the intricacies of kelp reproduction. So she came back with new ideas, and I came back with old ideas. And we put them together, and we came up with the BC idea.
I love that.
And that's the way that whole thing got going. That was a very rare instance where the government took the initiative and said, let's do something with this resource, and they retained me. I was very fortunate to be that person.
Yes.
And we went ahead and did it, and out of that came what we now know as the cultivation techniques that are used pretty well everywhere. They've branched off in the Faroe Islands. They do things differently than they do in England and they do in northern Germany, but it's all come from the same core.
Right. I know the Ministry of Environment was one of your initial sponsors, and did they have a particular interest in your research and in your farming?
It comes down to very personal situations. I knew the person who was making those decisions, and that person was very much aware of what I was doing. And we kind of shared a same vision of trying to figure out how to farm kelp. So he, representing the government, approached me, representing my desires, and we came up with this program, which cost quite a lot of money. I had 4 employees full-time for almost 4 years. And we had to do a lot of infrastructure development and stuff like that.
Now, Lewis, why are you farming the kelp? Is the food aspect your main place of interest?
No, my main place of interest is through farming kelp, learning how to farm it better. I'm really into the technology of farming kelp. Now, I did all kinds of stuff, but right now, at this point in my life, I'm interested in making farming efficient for the various applications that may come out of it. And I'm particularly interested and concerned at how farming may interact with our loss of our giant kelp beds up here. Both here and in Washington State, we've lost a lot of the very significant big kelp, the ones that form the big architecture that fish live in and swim through and hide in on our coastal waters. And it's under environmental assault for one reason or another. And so farming is one way, and I can work on a technique for that, that might be able to go in and repair damaged beds or replace damaged beds or stress beds with a stronger variety of kelp. This is pretty presumptuous, but it's something that we think about.
Yes, now kelp does play a part in regenerating ocean ecosystems. Can you explain a little bit about contrasting and comparing putting up a forest or starting another forest and growing trees for carbon sequestration and getting it out of the air. But the ocean and the kelp actually does this so much more, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the ocean sucks up the carbon. But the ocean can only suck up so much carbon. And when it becomes saturated, it won't take up any more. But by having this kelp forest, as you mentioned, those plants can suck that carbon up and take it out of the water, you know, tie it up as plant material. And that leaves a void then for more carbon to enter the ocean from the atmosphere. And it's the carbon in the atmosphere that's causing the greatest problem, we assume, through its greenhouse effect.
However, then, when you have the kelp doing its thing with the carbon, it's then important to harvest the kelp, isn't it?
Yes. So there's some people that are looking at this very seriously right now. So we have an equation. The light falls on the ocean, and the kelp takes it up. And we can actually talk about the amount of carbon taken up per square meter per year by kelp. So now we know how much carbon being captured by the kelp. Now, as kelp goes through its cycle, and it's a short-lived plant, as it goes through its cycle, a lot of that carbon is returned back as carbon dioxide, just through decomposition, bacterial action, and such. But a certain fragment of that, and I'm not quite sure how much, actually will be taken out of the equation and removed from the carbon cycle. It can land on the bottom as detritus in deep water and be buried, but we don't know that percentage. But the flip side of this is if you take the carbon, the plant, out of the water, no matter where you take it, that carbon sooner or later is going to be released. But if you use that carbon from the plant for a process such as making biofuel, then all of a sudden the carbon that's being cycled is not the fossil carbons, not the petroleum products, but the kelp. So if you keep that other carbon in the ground, we're not adding more to the bigger equation, and we're taking what's already out there in the atmosphere and water and cycling it around and around and burying some of it over time as the kelp falls down and gets buried and becomes the next big oil field or something.
Right, yes. And then also the farmers are getting so hip to using kelp in regenerating minerals into their land, which will translate, of
yes.
course, into the plant life and to us. So that's very exciting. But I'm a little concerned hearing you speak that the kelp fields are declining. Now, what technology are you working on in order to help that from happening so severely?
What we're doing is kind of twofold. The first of all is we're trying to figure out why it is declining. So two broad views. One is it's some kind of an episodic event. Something happened that smacked them down, and they haven't had time to come back, but maybe they will on their own. Now, talk about the big blob. This is a warm intrusion of low-nutrient seawater that will come into the coastlines. And it devastates everything. It's too warm for the cold water species, and it's low in nutrients, so the plants that do hang on can't do well. The other one is the chronic situation. And the chronic situation is global warming, for example, oceanic warming. Now, we know the waters are getting warmer. We measure them year after year after year, and they're getting warmer. There's no question about it. That is chronic. You can't just wait around for something to repair that, because that's just going to get worse. So what we're trying to do is identify populations of kelp that seem to be warm water tolerant and then use those to produce seed through farming type of techniques to go back into these areas where the kelp has been removed because it couldn't take the earlier stress. It can take it now because we have a stress-resistant variety. That's a lot of talk and a lot of work, but those are goals that we're shooting for. And the other, on the more technical side and more resolvable side, is how do you actually plant or replace a destroyed kelp bed?
That was my next question.
Yeah. So very recently, people have rediscovered the concept of what they call green gravel. This is where you essentially take gravel, crushed up rock, and you seed it with baby plants in the lab. And then you take these out and kind of Johnny Appleseed-like spray them over the waters where they will settle down, and hopefully some of them will become established and replace the displaced kelp head. And another approach is to take the actual kelp farm, make miniature farms, and this is being tried now. And you go into an area where these natural beds are under assault or have been removed, and you just build a little farm there, and you cultivate it, and you let it grow. And then when it reaches maturity, hopefully it will reseed the area around it through a natural process of producing spores and then eggs and sperm and all that stuff.
Yes. Are you seeing good results from starting in the lab and then putting it out in the water?
Well, for the farming, yes. Our little company actually commercially produces seed for people, both for environmental work and also for just commercial farming, yeah.
You know, Louis, I'm wondering, since you spent a year in Japan where they have been doing this for just generation after generation, did they have some insights into climate changes that have happened over the years or anything like that?
I have to say, I don't really know, but I've actually worked with Japanese phycologists, those people who work with seaweed, for over 40 years. And so I've joined up with them in several projects. And it's never been really the focus, but I know that they are looking now at more open ocean farming, I say, rather than in the bays and such, which is one way to get around this problem if you have some really brilliant engineers around. I think a better example to look at it would be China.
Okay.
I don't know if you know the Chinese story and its kelp farming history.
Please share.
After the Second World War, the Communist Party took over China, and Mao Zedong decided that he was going to make China independent of the rest of the world. Now, this is a pretty big statement to make, but one of the things they had to do was to achieve a source of iodine if they're going to be independent. So they decided they were going to farm kelp. The problem is that the Yellow Sea, which is their major body of water that they had access to, is too warm for kelp. So they went to Japan and they got some of the what's called ma kombu. It's a beautiful kelp species. And they brought it back to China and they put it into refrigerated swimming pools. And they subjected these plants, as they grew them, to various carcinogens through X-ray, chemical mutagens and such. And they finally came up with a warm water tolerant species. So now they're producing, 2 years ago, about 2 million wet tons of kelp. That's more than the rest of the whole world produces. And all that's produced in the Yellow Sea, which is too warm for natural kelp populations. We can really do just about anything we want to do.
Yes, and they're finding it to be as nutritious and have as much iodine. And
yes. In fact, beyond just getting warm tolerant, they now have species or varieties, I should say, that are better at sequestering iodine from seawater. So I've been asked, can we mass produce kelp, say, as a substitute for gasoline? In fact, British Columbia has a regulation that by a certain year, and it's coming up pretty quick, I guess, that 5% of our gasoline has to contain fuel that is derived from a renewable resource. So it's been played out as a model, and they can do that in British Columbia. And it would take an area of about 20 by 20 square miles, farming the ocean, and we could replace 5% of the gasoline used in British Columbia with this bio-renewable fuel.
In a 20 by 20 mile radius, that's quite phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. What they're doing is they're trying to produce ethanol from the kelp. I call this kelpanol. I think we should put that word in our vocabulary.
Well, my gosh, I mean, if it's using all this GMO corn or kelp, count me in for the kelp. That's all I can say. Kelp has been integral in the part of world you live in with the indigenous community, pretty much, and you've saw it in Japan forever, and part of an economy that sometimes isn't put into the equation is the community and the strength of the community. And farming kelp would put so much back into the community, wouldn't it? Because farming kelp could create jobs, and it just would create this cohesiveness that is really the first step for any strong economy, I think.
Yes, no, that's definitely true. So when I was in Japan, I spent a lot of time driving around Hokkaido, and I would drive into villages which were totally based on the economy derived from farming kelp. And here now, I mentioned these various companies that are going into looking at plastics or horticultural products or carbon for protein and such. They are working with First Nation peoples.
Oh, lovely.
So a lot of these companies will actually be in partnership, and they will be deriving their access to the First Nation territorial waters for the farming kelp, and the First Nation people themselves will be participating in the activity. So a lot of these little places will have a bit of life shot into them. I'm speaking to you now from a place called Bamfield on the west coast of Vancouver Island. Population, 150 people in the winter and about 300 in the summer when all our gentrified homes become occupied by lawyers and
right.
doctors and people. We say people from Calgary, as we say here in Canada, rich people. It's quite an interesting neighborhood, and there's nobody here.
Oh, my goodness.
For a couple of months.
Well, I'm coming to visit.
Okay, but please do. Yeah. I want to touch on one thing. I was trying to go that way when I talked about China. They just said they're going to do this, and they did it. And so they didn't have to go out and be friends with the neighbors or anything and talk them into thinking it would be okay to have this in their front yard. If you try to do that here in North America, first of all, you have to have a political will. Politicians have to see that this is something to be for the better good for the greater number of people. For example, there was a group in Washington State who came up with a scheme for growing nori, which is very famous from Japan, and that's the stuff you're wrapped in. And so they came up with it, and they put these farms in, and then all of a sudden the upland owner said, no, we don't want to look at floats on our water. We want pristine sunsets. And, of course, the upland owners around Puget Sound are your doctors and your lawyers and your people of influence. So that industry was killed here. This is Washington State now. You can run into that problem anywhere where there's going to be a conflict of interest. Yes, we can go out there. We can take our 25 square miles or whatever it is to produce this fuel supplement, but someone is going to be upset. That's where I fish. That's where I have my summer cabin. My kids grew up here. All these kinds of things going on, and we're not communists. We can't just say tough. Those are issues that have to be resolved. I think the technical issue, and China has shown us the way here, is we can do this.
Right.
I mean, I know we can produce the seed, and we can do the farming, and with the approach we're taking now, and there are people down in California that are looking at the genetics of the various varieties of kelp, we can come up with varieties that will resolve some of the problems of environmental change. They can meet some of the requirements of very special products and such. The political will and the public will are be the big problem.
As you see all of these possibilities and with the four companies coming in by you, do you feel some kind of alarm? I guess there's been a lot of research as to over-harvesting or researchable anyway to know that.
Yeah. What I don't know is what is this vast kelp cultivation of the Yellow Sea done to the Yellow Sea? I know some of the researchers there, but they're quite academic, and I don't know if they would exchange their ideas with me or not on that. In our coastal waters right now, if we just look at the wild kelp beds are supporting the shallow water ecosystem. The kelp are capturing the light, and they're sloughing off their tissue, and they're dying, and cycling down through the carbon cycle, and being picked up by little shrimp-like things. For example, cormorants have been found to have up to about 50% of their carbon derived from kelp. The food chain. So the kelp beds are driving all of that. So it's a very important thing. Now, if you superimpose on those wild beds, just immediately say outside them in a little bit deeper water, a farming structure which is producing an equivalent amount of kelp as maybe the nearshore natural beds are, what are you doing? I'm saying that the way we're looking at it right now, you're just putting more carbon in a usable form, i.e. carbohydrates, proteins, and such, into the water, into the ecosystem, so that it dribbles down, that lands on the little polychaete worms and the little shrimpy things that get eaten by sole and halibut and, right. and on and on and on up to us. So the whole system actually benefits from it.
Yes. I'm glad you took a detour from your botany world, unknowingly anyway. You know, Lewis, you've been able to also write some fantastic novels living in British Columbia on this beautiful little island that you do. And also, I'm sure you've had some surprising and or far-fetched experiences because of your interest in seaweed. Is there one that comes to mind that you could share?
Well, I live to tell people about my near-death experience studying seaweed. So it was a dark and stormy night many, many years ago on the west coast of Vancouver Island, a place called Port Renfrew. And I was out with a friend of mine, John Green, who is a fish biologist, and he was studying tide pool fishes. So we're out there, we have our foul weather gear on, we have these kerosene lanterns, and we're standing up on this rock, and he's measuring fish, and he's shouting at me. I have a tape recorder around my neck. The name of the fish, Alibiocaudus maculosus, male, 18 millimeters long. And so I'm recording this both by hand and on my recorder. And in the background, you hear this roar. It's a stormy night. And then all of a sudden, you hear me say, "Oh, it looks awfully white out there." And John, my friend, says, "Look out, there's a log." So this wave came over the point I was standing on. The log hit me in the chest, knocked me into the ocean. Foul weather gear, no flotation, nothing. This is it. And then the next thing I know, John says, "You came back." So a wave picked me up and threw me back out. It's all on a recorder. Right now, I get a chill thinking about it.
My goodness.
I think what the world would have lost if I would have stayed in the water all those years ago.
Wow.
Anyway, that's one of the stories. Yeah. There's lots of stories.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to tell me about meeting up with some amazing chefs or something.
Well, you have to talk to my wife about that. Chefs are a different breed. I can talk to my neurosurgeon, Bob, but I can't talk to Bob, the chef. I have to talk about Chef Bob. They're delightful people, but they're about as eccentric as they come.
Oh, that's great. Is there something that you'd like to add to this conversation, Lewis, that I neglected or missed?
I would just say that rather than just focus on kale, focus on anything that really captures your attention.
Yes.
And if you want to make a mark in the world, and by that I mean you look in the mirror and you say, "I'm somebody different and unique," you just go out there and you nail something. It could be a lichen that grows on a tree. You know more about that lichen than anybody in the whole world.
Right.
So you're very unique. Among billions of people, you're a unique person. You look yourself in the face in the mirror in the morning and say, "That's it." And maybe that lichen might be the answer to the next plague. Who knows?
Wonderful.
Anyway, find your kelp. That's it.
Yes. That's great. I think that should be a bumper sticker. It would raise a lot of questions, right? Find your kelp.
Yeah, well, I like that.
Thanks so much to Louis Durol, our in-house kelp guru. I love it. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for our weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes and other podcast sites as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.